Welcome to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns. Real people, real voices, real lives, discussing mental health, addiction, and disability in the community. Your weekly window to the real world. Welcome to Take It From Us.
Welcome to Take It From Us. Our special guest today is Justin Rees-Larkham. After a highly successful career in the British Army, Justin Rees-Larkham had an equally glittering and well-rewarded career. He had everything. He was successful in the world of insurance. He was being fast-tracked for further success and promotion in a global company. He had wealth, a big house, a Porsche, a Mercedes. He had a beautiful wife and three sons. He lost it all through an addiction to online gambling, blowing £750,000 in just 3 years. Realising he could fall no further, and with the support of his parents and siblings, he was able to turn his back on gambling for good. His TED talk, titled The Rise and Fall of a Gambling Addict, has been viewed almost 1 million times on YouTube. Justin, a warm welcome to Take It From Us here in New Zealand. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, as well as can be expected after a two-month stay in hospital.
Tell us about, do you wish to share some details about the accident you had a few weeks ago?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we're all one step away from it, I think. It was just a normal standard accident. I was in hospital with an international rugby player who'd broken his back, with someone who'd been involved in a hit and run. And I had nothing exciting to say other than I stood up too quickly, slipped on one of my son's comics. I took full force on the bridge of my nose. My 102 kilograms snapped back my neck, and I fractured two vertebrae and really badly damaged another.
Wow. And how are you doing now?
Yeah, this last week is significantly improved. I was feeling very low mentally as well as physically, and I wasn't expecting to make a full recovery. And, you know, we'd had those conversations in hospital about, well, you know, have you considered paralysis, and have you had thoughts about how life would be for you if you didn't make a full recovery? And then this last week I've just said, you know, I think I'm going to recover from this. I think I'm going to make a full recovery. Right now my walking is kind of average. I get tired quite quickly. I don't have full feeling in my hands, but we're getting there, my friend. We're getting there.
You're tapping into that growth mindset, and I guess it's helped you to be at home. You've noticed a big difference in your recovery since you returned to, I guess, a warm and inviting environment. Probably no surprise that you've seen some progress.
No, you're absolutely right. I feel more comfortable here. I have a bit of home cooking, plenty of vitamins in, being sensible about, you know, what I'm drinking, all of those things, and having friends around me. And you know what? You're going to hear me talk quite a lot tonight about having friends, because I've really realized the importance of having friends around me.
Now, I guess you could say shot to fame, or certainly shot to prominence a few years ago with quite a powerful TED talk. And I would encourage our listeners to go on and have a look. And it's only 15 or 16 minutes long, but you pack a lot into one quarter of an hour telling your life story, the rise and fall of a gambling addict, and how life really spiraled out of control for you over a period of 2 or 3 years. You tell us where the best place to start with your story is.
Well, I reckon I'm going to start just before I had my first bet. So I'm ex-military, 10 years in the army, two operational tours, saw some pretty bad stuff in Bosnia on a peacekeeping tour, went to the city, had everything you could possibly imagine, great career, lovely wife, one child, another one on the way. And my first child, Matthew, had an epileptic fit and literally stopped breathing in my arms. And I think the trauma of that triggered something maybe that I hadn't dealt with when I left the army. Because the way I dealt with that is that I found gambling. I was just watching a game of rugby, done it 1,000 times before, but I noticed one of the adverts. I wasn't a gambler. I might have done a sweepstake in the office. I didn't really understand how that worked, but that was it. And then I got my laptop and I put down this £5 free bet. And that was it. I was away. I was escaping.
And you escaped to where?
Away from the reality to a place that I suddenly felt excitement. So I'd stopped playing rugby a few years before. My job had reached a bit of a plateau. I'd been in sales, which was quite exciting. I was now in management, well paid, but not particularly pushed. I had a long commute to work, facing the reality of having a son with a severe disability, and he would have it forever. And it was a place where I could get that buzz again. And I guess if you asked me, I would tell you, yeah, again, I'm a thrill seeker. And that's what I was looking for.
But also the time on your own, 6 hours, was it the car or the train every day? That's a lot of alone time and a lot of alone time to be thinking. Do you think when you look back that perhaps very slowly, perniciously, without even realizing it, you were slowly disconnecting from people who were close to you?
Definitely, absolutely, definitely. And, you know, after I'd found gambling, I remember phoning up my boss and saying to him, look, I'm not being productive to you up here, you know, coming into the office every day and spending all that time on the train. I'll work from home. So they set me up from home and I literally did my work in the first couple of hours of the day. Emma had gone to work. I was left on my own. And I do think coming back to issues around mental health and issues around gambling, we push the people that we love away. And yet, I believe we are created to be in community with each other. We are much better at functioning as human beings when we've got people around us. And you're right, I pushed everyone away because I didn't want them to know when it had become more than just a little flutter, more than a little bit of harmless fun. I didn't want them to see what I was doing. So I made up reasons to be on my own. To close the door off and tell my wife, no, I can't help with the bedtime routine tonight because I'm doing something in my office, which was a complete lie. And lying's stressful because you've got to remember what you've lied about. And it just goes round in a nasty circle.
And did you become a compulsive liar?
Yeah, I think I probably had forgotten what truth was. I'd never had any secrets from my wife before. But when it came to gambling and managing my finances without, I was ashamed of it. I didn't want her to know, pretty much because I wasn't actually very good at it. And I was losing more than I was winning.
No one's good at gambling.
Yeah, exactly. Apart from the bookies are the only ones that win. Yeah, mate. Yeah, absolutely. But I was in this cycle and it wasn't very nice. I am a competitive person and I'm a bad loser. And those are not good traits if you're a gambler. Now, if you're in the army or if you're on the rugby field, those are the traits you want. You want never to give up. If someone puts a wall in front of you, you learn how to get over it, round it, under it. However, with gambling, if you hit a wall, you've got to back off and stop and go, okay, I'm not going to chase my losses. That was bad. I got burned. I need to walk away. I could never do that.
And I guess too, with the online gambling, even when you're at your lowest point and you know that you've lost a fortune, do you get sucked into that just frantic optimism and hope that, hey, within the next 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes, all of my problems are going to go away because I'm going to find a way to win, which then becomes a false dawn. Is that kind of how it was for you?
That's exactly it. Oh, you described it better than I ever could. That's exactly how it is. You win or you lose close enough to believe that next bet, it will work out in your favor because you are an eternal optimist. As a compulsive gambler, a problem gambler, however you want to label it, you're expecting to win. You're actually surprised when you don't. And no matter what you gamble on, even if it's the lottery where the chances of winning are so minute, you're still expecting that your numbers are going to come up. And literally you are surprised, which is why you feel that feeling of surprise, disappointment, shame, guilt. So to get rid of those negative emotions, those horrible emotions, which don't sit well with anyone, you go to the cash point. And you get some money out and you put it back in the machine. You go to your wallet, you find a card that's still got some money on it. Even if that money you need to pay a bill, to pay the mortgage, to pay the food, to buy some shoes for your children, you think, it's okay. Because those nasty feelings, I can get rid of them. This time I'll win. This time I'll get my money back and everything will be okay.
And I know that you've said this in the past. You're on record as saying that you asked yourself time and time again, why? Why? Did you ever come up with an answer?
Well, I think, you know, the last time I had a gamble was November 2012. So I put some distance, I put some time between me and a gamble. And I have been able to speak to some much more clever people than I am and actually to reflect on what happened. And I do think there were some reasons there. And I think maybe that trauma could have triggered the initial, you know, I'll escape, that feeling of boredom, those traits that I didn't really recognize. I was working from home. I had access to money. I had access to time. The guilt that I felt about lying on what I was doing was one of those reasons why I went back to it. Lots of triggers all around me would set me off to think, oh, it's Monday morning. Do you know what? I'm going to put the footy on. There's a big match coming up in New Zealand. Or I used to love that. I used to watch the rugby league all the time, and I'd avoid taking my son to school so I could watch it. And I mean, what kind of a father it would have been lovely for my son, for me to take him into school, to give him a high five, have a good day. But no, there I would be betting on something I really didn't know very much about. So yeah, I think there were lots and lots of reasons. It's a complex addiction, gambling addiction. There's two sides to it, aren't there? There's the physical side. You do this thing over and over again. It's habit forming. And actually, when you talk about pro sport, and I in this country, the three areas that I have the biggest heart for, professional sports people, those in financial services, and those either in the military or ex-military, they seem to have a higher propensity for gambling and problem gambling than other parts of the community. And the studies back that up.
Wow.
Swansea University here in the UK has done a really good study saying that if you are a military veteran, you are 10 times more likely to have a problem with gambling than if you were someone else.
Is that because of the time? There's a lot of dead time. I know this with athletes. There's a lot of dead time where they've got the financial means, but there's nothing to do because they've been to training, they've seen their mates, and they've got 3 or 4 hours on their own. Is that what drives it? It's just that the boredom or the lack of something to hold on to have an objective sort of goal for the day that leads into this behavior?
Yeah, that's part of it, my friend. Absolutely. So I went down to a professional rugby union side, Harlequins, because the owner of a high street bookie had called up the manager and had said, I've got to tell you, a lot of your players come in and spend all afternoon here. And I'm talking to some of the players and they're saying, you know, we can only train for a couple of hours a day. We can't train all day. We have intensive training for 2 hours in the morning. Yeah, we might have a bit of a break and go off and do some weights. We might do some analysis, but we've got a lot of downtime. And that's the same for the military. There are periods of intense activity and then a lot of downtime. Plus, those people are the kind of character traits that I was talking about. They're thrill seekers. They're people who are very competitive in what they do. They don't like losing. And those traits aren't great for gambling. So I talked about that physical aspect, doing the same thing over and over again. But there's also a chemical side to this addiction. When you press that button, it's not when you win. When you press that button and you stake money you cannot afford to lose, you get this massive endorphin rush. And that's really addictive. It's a good feeling, that pressing that button. Listen, this button that I've just pressed there, that's going to solve all my problems. I'm going to win big. I'm going to pay off my debts. I'm going to close my account down. I'm going to focus again on being a good husband, a good dad, good in the workplace. My mind's going to be present because it's not present right now. So these two sides, the physical side and the chemical side, you add those together and you get quite a complex addictive feeling, and it really only does affect a small proportion of people. Most people will bet normally. It's so funny when I go on the radio or TV, I'm asked straight, so you know, you must be anti-gambling then, and I'll say no. Generally it's when I've got someone, one of the operators there with me in a debate, and I'll tell them I am not anti-gambling. Most people will gamble fine. For me personally, I cannot have one more bet. And even though it was a long time ago, I will take no day for granted.
The thing with the online gambling and the poker machines is It's so easy to be sucked in by them because the bells, the whistles, the noises, the sounds, it's evocative. There's the thrill. They are designed for you. They are specifically designed. They've hacked our brains with these machines, haven't they? Where they're actually designed to be addictive. Because this is the thing I've come to really believe, Justin, and because a lot of people say, look, it's okay to gamble in moderation. It's okay to gamble small here and there. But if everyone gambled in moderation, the profit margin for these companies would be through the floor and they wouldn't make the money that they make. They need problem gamblers. They need gambling addicts to be sustainable as a business. Isn't that somehow perverse?
Yeah, I can completely agree. So in the UK, the studies have shown that you've got a very small proportion of people are problem gamblers. It's around about 1%. Of those who gamble go on to have a problem with it. But 60% of the profits are generated by that 1%. And unfortunately, here in the UK, the highest paid chief executive paid herself a bonus of £468 million last year. And she's the owner of Bet365. And that tells me just exactly what you were saying earlier. The bookies will win every time. They're quite happy with that. At the moment, we've got Euro football going on and the gambling adverts are through the roof. And I was with my, it's so tragic. I speak quite a lot in schools. And I was at my nephew's house and he's 17 and he invited some friends over to watch the first game. And they were having open discussions about William Hill, about the odds and about the bets that they placed. Age 17, before it's even legal. And I think there's a real issue, I don't even know if we've got time to explore it, Ken, about young people and how they get into gambling in the first place. Because yes, there's some very clever minds out there who will design the noises and look at the algorithms and give you a call or an email or land just when they know you're thinking about betting because you bet every Monday night on a particular sport. And they'll send you a deal or some odds or a so-called free bet. And there is no such thing as a free bet. You've got to earn 45 times before you can cash out. And a problem gambler never cashes out anyway, because it's not about the money. It's about the playing. But I am worried about young people. And I think they get into gambling through their games, through gaming.
Yeah, through gaming and through being bombarded with constant advertisements for this stuff. I mean, in New Zealand, it's been recommended time and time again around gambling and around alcohol. Stop sponsoring sports. Stop putting it on the TV. If you do, it'll make a difference. Because we all look and go, oh, yeah, first try scorer or whatever it might be. And it seems so harmless, but your story, you've given us a tremendous example of how easy it can be to just slide into a life-changing behavior, which is not for the better. So to your story, when did you know I have to now get help? This has to change. I cannot go on like I'm going.
Well, there was a horrible time when I first realized that gambling was a problem. And that was when I left my son in the car outside my house for 2.5 hours. Well, I had just gone to get his coat and I thought I'll just check my account, make sure that I've won that bet. I was meant to take him to the swing, spent very little time with him. And I came back downstairs after I'd emptied my bank account and Matthew had cried himself to sleep in the car. And on his face, the tears were just dried in these lines on his cheeks. And I thought, oh dear, this is not good. This is not normal. I've got a problem. But it still took longer for me to find that moment when I was able to put my hand up and say, I need help. And that was when I started to clear out the house. Emma had left. My wife, she'd taken the boys. I'd lost my job. I'd lost my car. I had very little money to gamble with, but I was selling things. I won the Sword of Honor for graduating top of my intake at Sandhurst. The proudest day of my life. And I was reduced to selling that sword in a shop to get some money to gamble with. When that sword had gone and I couldn't get it back, my mum came up from Kent. It's about a 4-hour drive to where I was up north. And she said, look, you know, you're going to be evicted. Your father-in-law's cleared off the rent arrears that I had owing. The landlord's going to take the place back. You can walk the streets or you can come back home and find some recovery. And I chose the latter option. But I cried my eyes out. I was broken. But, you know, I had to be broken because I'm unfortunately a very proud person and I don't like admitting it when I'm wrong, and I am often wrong. So it took that much to break me. I basically lost I had £750,000 of debt. I had a couple of bin liners of stuff, no job, no house, no car. And that was it. I just put my hand up and said, okay, I can't do this on my own.
Yeah,
I need some help.
But your family stuck with you through everything. They were there for you when you needed them the most.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I have five brothers and sisters and they all rallied round. I wouldn't say I was suicidal. Well, I was thinking about what it would be like for people around me if I wasn't around. Because, you know, life was bleak. But yeah, I went back home. I went to my mom's house. She had a spare room. I had nothing. And I just thought, okay, this is it. This is rock bottom. This is what it looks like. I'm gonna just start making small decisions that are the right decisions. And I'm going to surround myself with people who care. And I'm not going to be ashamed about telling them about my problem. I'm going to tell them. I thought they'd all judge me. I thought they'd shun me. I thought they'd say, you idiot. Very few people I know have ever said that. Most people realize that this is a quite horrible illness, and all addictions, no matter what that addiction can be, at some point you lose control and it becomes destructive. And it's incredibly hurtful. And gambling is horrible because it impacts other people. The studies have shown that for every one problem gambler, there are probably another 10 people around them adversely affected. But you push them away, and that's why they're adversely affected. It's when you open up and gather them in and you realize they're not going to judge you. They are going to help you. They're willing to support you, that things get better.
Talking to us today is Justin Rees-Larkham from his home in the UK. Justin published a couple of books a few years ago, Tales I Lose and One Day at a Time. You kind of just mentioned that there, the response from others. Generally speaking, when you put those books out and you were vulnerable and showed us some courage to tell your story and to put yourself out there to be judged, rightly or wrongly, by others, what was the response overwhelmingly?
Overwhelmingly, people didn't judge. I really thought they were going to. They didn't. Funny enough, people come up and they say, well, now you've been honest about this. And there's a lot of shame around this addiction. They are all addictions, but I think particularly for gambling addiction, because you can keep it so secret until the damage is done. There's this thing about, well, you know, I've been a real fool here. I've been an absolute idiot. And I'm so sorry. And people will come up and they'll say, look, I know someone like that. I know I've got a family member. I've got a friend. If you hadn't come up and said that, I would never have confessed that to my wife. And now we're doing okay. And I have wonderful stories about that from all around the world. People will send me little notes and I put a contact the author email at the back of one of my books, which maybe was a mistake, but and I get messages saying, thank you. You saved my marriage, or the story you've told has saved my marriage. And I just think in life, we've got to be honest. Things are tough. You know, I was brought up in the army. You keep a stiff upper lip. If you've got a problem, you deal with it. You don't talk about it to everyone else. Actually, I think now people are a lot better with mental health. And talking about something, letting it become, rather than keeping it inside where, you know, you can pretend it's not a problem, when you talk about it and it comes out, suddenly you've got this thing to deal with and you're able to start taking steps that will help you where other people can help you. And I think probably if you had asked me what's the most important thing you could ever do in terms of dealing with addiction or any mental health problem, it would be to talk about it, to share it. And whether that's with someone you trust and you don't want anyone else to know, fine. But talk about it. Don't keep it inside.
How different would the military look if the top brass adopted what you just talked about? leaning into vulnerability and encouraging the men and women on the ground to open up and to talk about their feelings?
Well, funny enough, I have had the opportunity to talk to the head of the British Army at the Ministry of Defence, and now have got involved with a solution. They've recognised it as a problem. People are taking their lives in the military. They're not being productive. It is impacting operational effectiveness. We don't want people with loaded weapons who've got a massive mental health problem. And they put their hands up and said, okay, well, what are we going to do about it? I think generally the military is a very different place to the military that I left. I actually left back in 2000. And I've had the privilege of going back into the military now over the last few years and visited a lot of units, Air Force, Navy, and Army, and in fact, overseas military units too. So I'm in the States, and I found a military that's much more willing to talk about mental health. So when they come off operational tours now, rather than doing what I did, which was just go on, have a 2-week break, they talk about it. And you've got an opportunity to talk to a mental health nurse, an opportunity to have a post-tour wash up where if there's something that you've experienced or seen that you want to talk about, talk about it. And that's much, much better. And I think it's the same now for gambling. They're beginning to realize in the UK anyway, that it's a problem and it needs to be dealt with. And prevention is so much better than cure. If we can get in there early, education every time.
Yeah, I'm with you there. Prevention before cure. Well, there's that phrase, isn't it? Like a pinch of prevention is better than a pound of cure, or words to that effect.
Awesome.
Yeah. And when you say that to people, they always nod. There's no skip. This is I work as my full-time job, Justin, is a health coach. I help people with behavioral change, and I do some mental health and well-being stuff as well. And when I talk about that, there's never any skepticism. There's never any pushback. Everyone knows it to be true. It's got to be prevention. Let's get to the stuff early before it manifests into something really, really bad. Yet it almost feels like we can't quite get enough critical mass momentum to actually jump on top of the stuff.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to see compulsory education in schools around gambling. And I know there is for drugs and alcohol in the UK. It's getting there slowly. I think because smartphones now make gambling so, so easy. When I go into a school and I'll talk to 16, 17-year-olds or 16-year-olds, basically. And before I say anything, I'll ask them just, you know, would anyone please just be honest enough, put your hands up, have you got a gambling app on your smartphone? Every single time it shocks me, half, maybe a touch over half will put their hands up. And this is a year, 2 years before it's even legal to gamble. And as gambling becomes normalized, that they've beaten us to the prevention space. Because it's already, oh no, that's okay. The gambling addiction, that's not going to affect me. I'm okay. I'm quite smart. I'm going to be the one that beats the system. I would love to see. I'd love to see. I actually think that New Zealand is way ahead of the UK in many respects here. Unfortunately, Australia is lagging behind everyone. And I'm doing a little bit of work. I was out in Australia earlier this year. But I think New Zealand are very wise to it. We've got to protect our young people. They're our future, and they're vulnerable when they're young. And let's tell them the truth. Let's tell them what the real odds are. How likely is it that you'll win? Let's have some real life stories of how gambling has been incredibly destructive. And then you can make an educated choice rather than listening to all the adverts that tell you gambling's fun. And you see your heroes, your idols on the football field, the rugby pitch, with gambling logos all over them. It's
we've glamorized it, haven't we?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting you mention Australia, because I go there every now and then. I've got a couple of brothers who live over there. And we think as Kiwis, we're so much like Australians, and we are to a point, and we're brothers, right? We stand shoulder to shoulder with the Aussies, but they have a punting culture over there that is just so far and away different to what I've experienced. I've lived in New Zealand for 40 odd years. We are not even close to that.
Yeah.
Here, which I actually think is a good thing.
Definitely. We've all got a lot to learn from each other, and that's why I love doing stuff like this, Ken, where I can talk from the UK perspective. But you know, it doesn't matter what nationality we come from. This is the same issue, and we are all humans, and we all suffer from it. And we've got loads that we can share.
What's the pushback from the gambling companies that you would talk to when it? But they would know your story now. They would probably know and accept. Just like the big tobacco, big alcohol, big pharma, big food, these companies know what they're doing. Social media companies, they know what they're doing. They know what how to target people, and they know the damages that they're doing. So where is there a redress from their perspective? What pushback do you get?
So I do think the gambling, and believe it or not, I do think the gambling industry has a conscience to a certain level. Someone who jumps off an office building in London or wherever it might be in Auckland, wherever it might be in Christchurch, and takes their own life, it's not great for business. So they don't want to see that happen. But in the same way, they've got a business to run. They've got shareholders that they deal with. And I think sometimes they are so far removed from that that they can forget what damage it's doing. Very often, I will go in and speak to a gambling company, particularly those people who work in the bookies, who work in the high street betting shops, who are seeing the damage on a day-to-day basis, people who are getting really mad with them. And they want some training in this. So I think generally that it's not great for the industry. When I go on the radio, when I go on TV and there's an operator there, they're scared because you can't argue against my story. It's impossible. My story is someone who's just really, really honest. I got myself into a mix. It's because I used this product. I am now homeless I lost my family, I lost my job. Very difficult to argue against that. The argument that they will come up with is, hey, wait a minute, it's not our product, it's the individual. And do you know what? If it wasn't gambling, they'd be addicted to something else. And okay, there may be some psychological truth in that, but the fact is that their product is destructive and is addictive for a lot of people, maybe a small percentage, a lot of people. So I think the industry needs to do more for that small percentage that are causing themselves to, you know, unfortunately, in the most extreme, to take their own lives, to have marital breakdown, to lose their jobs. You know, there's things I've seen with guys on the motorway services who are just playing the machines for hours while their sons stand outside because they're not even allowed into this area, stand outside, and they've got tears down their faces. Dad, please, can we go on our holiday? Can we have our weekend together that you promised me? And it's just tragic. And I think the industry needs to stand up and say, come on, let's do a bit more for those people.
And it's not that you're wanting to be a bad parent, or you're choosing to be a bad parent, or you even are a bad parent, because you love your sons, you love your kids, but you're in the grip of something that's more powerful at the time. And I think most people would understand, Justin, hey man, this could happen to any of us. Any of us could fall victim to making one or two bad decisions and taking us down a path we don't want to be going down. Do you often get a lot of empathy in that regard?
Yeah, completely. It's a nasty spiral, and it's a very slippery slope. It's a long, slow slope. So my gambling came from nowhere and destroyed my life in 3 years. But that's unusual. A lot of people that I talk to, they'll talk about they noticed their grandfather used to gamble on the horses, and you know, they've been brought up with it, and you know, it was a fun thing to go around to grandpa's house, and we try and win. I remember my grandfather used to play the pools, and they'd be effectively betting on having draws in football matches, and score draws had the most points. And I just remember getting all excited and my grandfather saying, you know, and if I win, then we're going to buy the contents of that toy shop for you. And I really genuinely thought that he was going to do that. And I think, yeah, it's a slippery slope. I think it's not something that people just pick up and put down. We are surrounded. We are bombarded by messages that say gambling is fun. And we need some health warnings to go with it.
Yeah, they call it the iron law of public health, don't they? Like there just has to be a public health intervention here. There just has to be, because we can't regulate ourselves. We can't trust ourselves to gamble moderately or to drink in moderation or to gamble responsibly as we have in New Zealand time and time again. Please gamble responsibly. Human beings can't be trusted in that way. So we actually need public health laws to come in. And then there's some pushback about the nanny state, but 5, 10, 15 years later, people have moved on. A lot of the people that push back have died, and younger people don't want this stuff for themselves, eh?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I think smartphone technology has fundamentally changed the landscape here. Yeah. You've got a casino in your pocket. Yeah. The most adept people at smartphone technology are the younger people, and they know how it's so easy, so easy. And that's part of the problem. I'm not anti-gambling. I just think people should understand that if they are a certain character, watch out, and that, you know, for some people it will become a problem. And yeah, it's something really close to my heart, Ken. Really,
I can imagine. And I can hear that in your voice. Tell us about the advocacy work that you have been doing. You've mentioned some of it. I imagine that must be hugely rewarding for you now too.
Massively. So if you look at recovery, those people who've been in the rooms and they've done the 12-step recovery through AA or whatever it might be, step 12 is having found a place of recovery. You actively look to help others. And that's the most rewarding thing you could ever, ever imagine. And I don't mind taking a call any time of night. I'll talk to someone. I much prefer it when it's the individual to say, I have a problem. What helped you? How can I do something about this? But very often it'll be from the wife of, or the mother of, or the father of. And that's not so great, because I can see how hard it, as a father myself, three boys, it must be so hard to watch them go through the pain of you know, the most extreme damage that problem gambling can do. But it needs to be from the individual to take ownership of it so that they're ready. You can't heal for anyone else. They've got to do it themselves, and that's tough.
Yeah. So you're hearing a lot of probably horrible stories from broken people just grieving the loss of their son or daughter as they know them to be, and it's impacting their gambling behaviors, impacting negatively on a wider range of people around them, and they're probably desperate for this person to be helped. But you're so right, it comes back to the individual, and if the individual's not ready to change, or doesn't want to, or is stubbornly refusing to, it's not much will probably come of that. Is that what you found?
Completely, totally and utterly. And I guess it's the same with all addictions, with all mental health issues. If you need to be the one that reaches out. You hear it quite commonly, and I'm sure you hear it in your line of work. It's much better for the individual who needs some counselling to contact the counsellor themselves, rather than have a partner say, "Oh, I've made a call for you. There's a meeting next Wednesday at 3 o'clock." I've got to take ownership of it. I've got to really want to recover, otherwise that recovery won't come.
Yes, you're so right. In my experience, when people reach out to me on behalf of someone else, there's almost zero chance that person they're talking about will follow through.
Yeah, so true, so true.
It's been wonderful to have you on the program, Justin. What are you hopeful for in your own life at this point?
Wow, what I'm hopeful for at the moment, I'm thinking, you always think about priorities in life, don't we? And someone comes on a recovery course that I might be involved in. If they've got a housing issue, you've got to deal with the housing issue before they talk about their recovery. If someone does have a mental health issue, they've got to go and have that dealt with before we can talk about, you know, the problem of addiction that might be in their life. So for me right now, my primary need is to heal physically. Having broken my neck, I'm a physical person. I love to swim. One day that Cook Strait is going to be in my
country. All right.
I can assure you. Yeah. I swam in February in Manly with the the Manly Breakfast Swimming Club, and they swim across to Shelley Beach, and I quite enjoyed that. I'm a cross-channel swimmer, so I swam UK to France, and that's recognised as one of the most arduous. So I basically, I'm going to go off tomorrow. I fly out to the Canary Islands. I'm going to get swimming in the ocean, and hopefully that will help me recover. I'm not going to do anything too arduous. I would just be glad if I could be able to swim again, because at one stage in hospital over the last couple of months, I didn't think that was going to happen. Just so for me, I'm thinking
just being in the water will be wonderfully healing for you, I'm sure.
Yeah, be a bit of sunshine. We haven't had a particularly good summer here in the UK. It's rained every day. You might think that happens all the time. Actually, we do sometimes get a bit of sun. We've had nothing here at all. So, hoping for a bit of sun.
Have a wonderful time wherever you go. And, look, thanks so much for being so generous with your time and for sharing your